Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, welcome back to the show. Today's episode is a follow-up that marks the passing of the one-year anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Last year, towards the start of the war and my 30-day series, I interviewed Elbridge Colby. Elbridge is the author of The Strategy of Denial, American Defense in an Age of Great Power Conflict, and he was the lead architect of the 2018 National Defense Strategy. Last year's episode focused on how the war in Ukraine relates to the Asia-Pacific, specifically whether it would either encourage or discourage a Chinese invasion of Taiwan. I know this episode actually did really well because folks had a lot of thoughts on that topic, so this is a great way to check in with a previous guest and see how their thought has evolved over the course of the past year. All that said, hope you all enjoy this conversation, and thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting The Realignment. Elbridge Colby, welcome back to The Realignment.
Great to be with you, Marshall.
Yeah, we're past the one-year anniversary of the war in Ukraine, but also we're nearing when we first published one of our first initial response episodes, which is basically titled, Is Taiwan Next? It was based upon an article that you put out in the Wall Street Journal. So let's just start by revisiting that piece. Your central claim, point of advocacy, takeaway was a war in Ukraine could serve as a humongous distraction to the United States' priorities in Asia, specifically Taiwan. You were explicitly concerned about a very, very, very large ramped up U.S. troop presence in Europe. How do those concerns feel today? And how over the course of the year did you think that dynamic played out?
Well, thanks, Marshall. It's great to be with you, and a pleasure and a privilege. Unfortunately, I fear that I think my fears were well grounded. I think they unfortunately have been vindicated. I think if you look at the situation today, you have a large U.S. troop presence, considerably larger than before the war. That was notionally sort of discussed as being temporary, but there are no signs of it declining anytime soon. More fundamentally, you have a consuming attention by the United States political establishment on Ukraine and on Europe. The United States, figures differ, but I saw, in reputable reporting, I think $112 billion, which has gone to Ukraine. And to be clear, for those, who don't know my position is that we should support Ukraine, but consistent with a genuine prioritization of rectifying the military balance and the strategic balance in Asia. And that is not happening. I would say that there has been some progress, on the secondary or back burner level. So I don't want to underplay that. There have been important steps, for instance, with allies, Japan increasing defense spending, posture moves, et cetera. The Pentagon is consistent that its force development over time is focused on China. But that's distinctly secondary. And clearly the political level in the United States is focused on Europe. The administration's formal documents say that they're prioritizing Asia, but President Biden went to Kiev the other day and said part of his heart was in Kiev. So, I think we don't have to speculate. And it's more than just political attention. There's been a lot of things. The way I would describe it, Marshall, is there's a lot of sense that there has been an awakening to the danger of great power war, geopolitical competition, et cetera. But those things, the fixes to those things have not gone through the formality of happening yet. So actually the situation is worse now. So for take an example, the defense industrial base. There's a lot of attention to the defense industrial base. That's important, but it's equivalent in a sense to like saying that you have a drinking problem. Okay, you have a drinking problem, but are you actually going to kick it, right? Dave Norquist, the former acting Secretary of Defense, pointed out recently in House testimony that the situation has actually deteriorated. Moreover, the war, a month ago, this was still a somewhat heterodox view. Now it seems to have definitively become the conventional wisdom that this war is likely to go on for a long time. Frankly, even if it ceases, even if the Ukrainians achieve a decisive victory, which I hope for, the Russians are not going to go away, are very unlikely to go away. So this problem is not going to go away. And so my basic kind of bottom line is we are not going to be able to sort of wiggle our way out of the necessity of choice. And I believe our stated national priority on China and focusing on Taiwan is correct, but we are not actually going through it. And so I analogize the situation today to continue. Let's continue with like the, you know, the medical issue is like, we know, we've got an acute heart disease diagnosis. We know we have to lose weight. We think we're on a diet, but that diet is not really the one that we need to lose a lot of weight. And that is, so it's actually a very difficult situation rhetorically or politically that I often find myself in, because people don't contest that China should be the priority directly. They don't contest that Taiwan, we should do more for Taiwan, but they try to like make sort of indirect secondary sort of triple bank shot arguments that obviously don't help the situation in Asia. And that's, it's harder to sort of negotiate how to rectify the situation now.
Yeah. There's a million things I want to get more double down on. So A, to your point about the commitment to Asia, President Biden goes to Kyiv and he says his heart is in that city. Obviously, as you know, as most people know, he can't do the equivalent in Taiwan on 15 different levels. So Right. Let's make it explicit. What would a tangible, from your perspective as an outsider, commitment look like beyond just the superficial? Because what's funny is he can't even make the superficial move. There is no equivalent of going to Berlin and giving, a Kennedy speech. So what would that look like tangibly to you?
Well, he could. He could go to Tokyo, or he could go to Okinawa, or he could, I mean, you can't go to Taiwan, but there's plenty of things he could do. I mean, moreover, the political symbolism by the way, the president sort of offhandedly said like four times now that we're going to defend Taiwan. I think this is a very important point that the president clearly prioritizes Europe. No question in my mind. I think it's visible to everybody, but that's not the whole totality of the problem. We could have spent $112 billion fixing our defense posture in the Pacific, which is not adequate. I mean, and if you listen to what the Indo-PACOM commander is saying, the senior military officials, defense experts, et cetera, it's clear that we're not where we want to be. And of course, meantime, it's not another thing that's become conventional wisdom that was a quote unquote fringe or marginal view a couple of years ago is that like China wants to have the ability to take over Taiwan by 2027. Like, just to be clear, I don't make predictions. I don't think it's inevitable. Like people sometimes put this on. I'm not saying that. I don't know when. I have no idea what Xi Jinping's going to do. But what I do know is they're undertaking a massive, unprecedented historical military buildup, specifically, clearly, very clearly designed to take on the United States. And secondly, he specifically said that he wants the ability to take over Taiwan. Not only is this like some reading the tea leaves, Bill Burns, the CIA director, who's considered a very sober, understated guy, he said the other day that U.S. intelligence indicates that China and Xi Jinping has given the order to be ready by 2027. Doesn't mean it's going to happen, but like, I mean, seriously? Like, I can't believe I actually have to make this argument. I mean, if somebody's like, hey, your car is mine and like, I should have it, and like, he's casing your house, that's all you need to know, right? So that's the reality. I mean, there's a lot of sort of over Baroque sort of arguments about, well, the fate of Taiwan is going to be settled in Ukraine, which largely tendentious. It's pretty simple. It needs money. It needs political prioritization. It needs effort. It needs focus, et cetera. By the way, I'm not in favor of like recognizing Taiwan independence. I'm not in favor of provoking the Chinese. Actually, I'm quite worried about that. I thought it was a bad idea for Speaker Pelosi to go to Taiwan, for instance. But like, let's hit the gym really and not just talk out of both sides of our mouth.
I just want to do a quick call out to your point about not making predictions. I was reading some of your Wall Street Journal writing, and you make a great habit of not making those predictions. So for folks
who want to
go back into your archives, like your piece on the industrial base from last July has aged well, because you're just describing the situation and you're not saying X, Y, and Z thing. I think a lot of
folks. And if I do, I'd welcome people calling me out. I was actually going back and forth. If I have made overconfident predictions, I'd love to be notified and I will correct them, because I don't have a crystal ball.
So I think the next question basically would be, I'm curious how, just thinking about American history, because I think the thing in the back of everyone's mind, I think one of the books back here is Arthur Herman's book about American business in World War II and reindustrialization. There's, I think, in the back of the mind, the backstop if you're someone who's directionally center left pro Taiwan is, look, we always struggle. There will be a ramp up. America has the industrial capacity. These are some of the comments actually on that Wall Street Journal piece. So what is your response to that?
Wrong. It is our historical background. It's just wrong. In fact, Robert Kagan made what I think is like a tremendously self-describing error along these lines in a huge Wall Street Journal piece. I went back and forth and they didn't correct it, but it was so revealing because obviously Kagan is sort of like the spokesman of the sort of epicenter of the blob. And to make such an error was so revealing about this exactly your point, Marshall, that this is like
one quick thing. Bridget, I want to call out for folks. Robert was on the show last month. So if you want to listen to that after you hear Bridget say that, I think this is the one podcast that's featured the two of you.
That's great. I love a good debate. Nearly.
So yeah, exactly. Excellent. Sorry, no, go on now with this comment.
Congrats to you, Marshall. That's awesome. You know, I think you're exactly right. It's just factually wrong. I mean, first of all, in economic scale, China's roughly equivalent to the American economy. If you use market exchange, which tends to over probably state the importance of the dollar, which props up the size of our economy, we still are larger. It's possible we may always be larger than Chinese, but we're in the same order of magnitude. If you use purchasing power parity, which is more relevant to military and strategic affairs because it has to do with things that are produced domestically, for instance, at lower labor costs, the Chinese are way above us already, or they're above us already, and they're heading to higher as they move up the value chain and so forth. So this is the thing Kagan got wrong. The United American economy alone was larger than the three axis, major axis powers. And we were allied with the British Empire and the Soviet Union. We were always far larger than the Soviet economy, which we probably overstated its size. We're larger than Imperial Germany. So we have not been in a situation where we are not clearly the largest economy in like 150 years. Moreover, this is even worse, and Matt Stoller points this out, we probably overstate, especially in a kind of military context, our economic advantages because we're largely a service economy now. The Chinese have the largest, they are the industrial, they are America in 1941. That's the problem, right?
Interesting.
And like, this is the thing that Elon Musk tweeted of my thing, which is that the Chinese have 13 naval shipyards, I think, and we have four, but one of their shipyards is larger than all four of ours. So like, who are we kidding that we can walk and chew gum at the same time? It's surreal that we think that this is a realistic approach to, and I'm not even like, I'm not one of these people who thinks that the Chinese are a bunch of communists who are going to brainwash us, whatever. I mean, Xi Jinping is a communist, but like, I'm not worried that much about like them, you know, polluting our bodily essence or whatever it is from Dr. Strangelove. You know, that I'm just like, whoa, like, shouldn't we be taking these people at value, like seriously? And I think that's a huge part of the problem. And that gets to the big problem, which is people are like, hey, we've woken up. And it's like, yeah, but like, we haven't fixed the problem at all. In fact, orders are slower than ever. And by the way, there's a huge number of orders for the Europeans and the Ukrainians and stuff with a defense industrial base that's like a, you know, boa constrictor, like, you know, digesting something. So we are in bad shape. I mean, it's not unsalvageable. We can do it if we put our minds to it, but it's we need to recognize the seriousness of the problem.
I think the thing that's interesting here then is that to some degree we are constrained, and you're telling by the World War II metaphor, because the World War II metaphor in almost every aspect is positive to us. So you're going to have a horrific end of 1941. You're going to have some really tough slogs in 1942, but ultimately by 1943, 1944, 1945, momentum, inherent strengths, that defense-based potential. Right. Could you just really give the audience a strong picture of the implication of China being us in 1941? Because I haven't heard it quite articulated that way. Like, what does that mean as we think of a geostrategic or even like military conflict competition? Because we've never had that before. I think that's your underlying point.
Right. So just the scale of the American military buildup in, and by the way, it supplied the British and the Soviets to some degree. The Soviets also supplied a lot of their own equipment. Just the scale of the production, I mean, tens of thousands of aircraft. I think we had like, depending on how you define it, like, I mean, maybe like 20 main battle carriers, but like up to 100 like escort, if you include that. I mean, hundreds, well over 1,000 ships, I believe, et cetera. You know, weapons, blah, blah, blah. And like, I mean, my one example is like, we had a specialized ice cream ship that was there for the naval and marine force and army forces in the Pacific, for instance, just to give you a sense of the scale. The other thing we had was a Soviet Union that, whether, you know, we like them or not, I certainly don't, was willing to bear the brunt of the fighting. I mean, there were just 20 to 25 million, maybe more Soviet citizens died in that conflict. The United States lost about 500,000 you know, obviously an enormous tragedy for everybody, but like that was a very different situation. Now, I'm not comparing, I mean, the one-to-one comparison of World War II and God forbid a conflict with China is, you know, it breaks down. But I just think we need to really understand what the scale differences are and how bad of a situation we're in, you know, vis-a-vis China.
You know, and this is where the predictions dynamic becomes difficult. And once again, I'm not asking you for a prediction, but I'm asking you to think of two different scenarios. So it seems to me that if scenario one is a short, quick, and I don't mean short or quick in the like, I mean this in like the, you know, kind of like anecdotal sense, a sharp conflict with China over Taiwan. So this is where a lot of the war games talk about. Like it goes on for a few weeks, it goes on for a month. That seems to me to be the type of conflict where the structural weaknesses in our economy matter a little less. So it's a problem, but that's a dynamic versus a longer protracted conflict. This is the point about how there's a version of the war in Ukraine that goes until June. There's the version that we seem to be going into now, which is where almost everyone, to your point, noticing the vibe shift, is saying it's going to be a longer term conflict. How do you think about those two different scenarios, short, sharp conflict versus extended, protracted one?
Let me address the Ukraine part first, because I think this is really important, Marshall, and I want to put a fine point on it. There are a lot of people talking about at quick end of the war that if we increase arms support to the Ukrainians, that the war can be concluded quickly on favorable grounds. First of all, I'm not necessarily against providing more equipment, you know, from an escalatory point of view. I do think the threat of Russian nuclear escalation is real, so we should take it very seriously, and I should give the administration credit on that. But I'm not like for instance, my rule of thumb is if the Soviets supplied something to the North Vietnamese, then we should be prepared to give it to the Ukrainians. So that would lead me to be open to like F-16s. I'm not like against it. My concern is the trade-off. Here's the question I have for Hawks. What if the quick war fails, or if there is a quick war and Russia doesn't go away? This is what I don't get. Like, I have not actually seen a serious addressal of this. So Hawks are criticizing the Biden administration for being incremental and so forth. And I, you know, there's points to be made on that, but they're also hawkish on Taiwan and China. And like, we know we don't have the industrial base. We know we don't have. And by the way, there's not a huge appetite in the country for dramatic increases in defense spending. Yeah, maybe we'll get 3-5%. That's very important. But like, we're not going to double the defense spending, from what I can tell. I mean, not even Republicans are unified on that point. So like, how do you address that point? I mean, one of the things I try to do is what I'm laying out is a strategy broadly, kind of a strategic framework. You know, it's not a particular play-by-play, but like a strategic framework for how we address the various challenges to U.S. national interests, right? Mine is like, make sure you take care of the primary threat. Don't mess around. Don't cut it close. Get that right. Meet a denial defense standard. And then mitigate, you know, what you have left after you've done that, basically. I mean, not necessarily sequentially, but just kind of in priority terms. That's what you can make available for Europe. That is going to be less. So the Europeans need to step up to take primary support of the Ukrainians. That is feasible because of the Ukrainian economy. You know, the hawk view is we're just going to win and Russia's going to be cowed in the corner. And then we're going to shift to Asia, even though we know that Asia is not in good shape. I mean, the Hawks are serious about that point. So I just like, I don't get it. And I don't think, I mean, in this situation in which we're possibly in the most dangerous period, certainly since the Cold War, in some ways since the Second World War itself, I mean, there's an outright major war on the European continent. I think we need to be serious. Like, we really need to grapple. You know, if people, like, I get that people might say, hey, Brit, you're over-focused on Taiwan and Asia. But then say that. Say, like, No. Maybe like I'd respect it a lot more if people were like, you know what? Taiwan's indefensible. It's not worth it. I'd rather take Ukraine, consolidate the position. I think that's in the back of the mind of some of the people, you know, behind the decision making in the Biden administration, actually. I think in the back of their mind, they're prepared to lose Taiwan, is my guess, because otherwise it doesn't, it's kind of a bluff. But I think like, I think it's incumbent upon Hawks to make a serious strategic argument about this point, reckoning with the reality that they know. I mean, the point I like to hammer on is for the last 10 to 12 years, the Hawks have been saying we've not been spending enough on defense. I mean, they are very articulate and eloquent about the impact of sequestration, which was very real on the defense department. Okay, so that presumably had some impact, right? Like, well, not presumably, like it definitely had a huge impact. Now we're living in that world. How do we deal with it? That's the real question. In terms of China and Taiwan, You're absolutely right, Marshall. So we have to expect a war, if it breaks out, God forbid, to be a protracted and attritional, a protracted one with China, because China will rightly understand that it has advantages. It's possible it doesn't happen, but again, we don't make predictions. But if it seems to be in their interest for a war to go on, we should assume that that's the case. That is to say, unless they win quickly over Taiwan, in which case they might just want to wrap the thing up, tie it in a bow, and then move on, and you know, rinse and repeat kind of thing. So I think the short war is critical, because if we don't defeat a Chinese attack on Taiwan, we're in a far worse position. In the same way that, like in World War II, it made a huge difference that France fell, but the war didn't end. To your point, to flip, right? We the Western allies benefited from a long war relative to the alternative, but it would have been better if France had held on. So in the same way, we've got to win the short war. Otherwise, we're going to be in a very tough position. I mean, the other thing is, if we hold Taiwan, their industrial capacity is a lot larger, but it's, and I go into this in my book, it's going to be hard for them to find ways to apply that greater industrial capacity. Doesn't mean it's easily addressed, but I think we'll be in a much better position to do so.
You know, there's actually a third scenario that I should have brought up in terms of the possibilities we have to prepare for. What about the possibility of like the blockade? Just the idea that they say to themselves, look, for good or for ill, the war in Ukraine has proved that you can't just make these big moves assuming it's going to work. So instead, blockade, call the U.S. bluff. It's far different to attack than to defend in that sense. What do you think about the blockade situation?
Yeah, I don't. I actually think the lesson is actually the reverse, and some of what Burns has said indicates, this is a few months ago, that he agrees. Let me go
through. By Burns, you mean the CIA director.
CIA director. So one is, blockade is not a great strategy for China. So actually, if they try it, I actually think that might not be the worst thing for us. I mean, I'm not hoping for it, but like, it's better than the alternative. Because the way a blockade works is it imposes such horrible costs on the targeted population that they give up. So people basically starving and dying in the streets, and people losing medical care because power goes off. That's going to put China in a bad situation. And it tends not to work when countries are talking about their fundamental independence. I mean, small I here in the case of Taiwan, their autonomy. In fact, I actually don't think there is an example of a country using blockade to force another country's capitulation. It's often part of that, like in the Civil War, World War One, or something like that. But it's not the main kill mechanism, largely because countries directly attack when they have the ability to mount a blockade, because it's much more effective.
Quick question. Isn't the fact that Taiwan is an island
So let me get to that. It's an island. Yeah. It's more vulnerable. Right. So like in World War II, the Germans obviously, initially they tried a direct attack. That was the Battle of Britain, was the setup for that. And then they decided not to do it. But then they did the U-boat campaign. Well, you know, which could have worked. It's not impossible. The problem there is, yes, Taiwan's an island, but this is going to set up, and there's two points. One is it prompts the U.S. and they lose the element of surprise. One is that would be a belligerent act. It would put U.S. credibility and so forth on the line with respect to Taiwan. Okay, is the U.S. going to break the blockade? I think we absolutely have to. Like, I mean, we're totally unreliable if you don't do that. So essentially what the U.S. does is this would not be easy, but it is manageable. You know, the U.S. flagged tankers in the Iran-Iraq war era and so forth. This is something that has happened many times in history. We would just essentially challenge and break the blockade. And I think China, or hopefully that it was China that shot first. So we would seem like the defending party, which would catalyze U.S. and allied resolve. Here's the problem. If that happens, the United States is going to be generated and ready for a conflict to escalate. And so China would lose the element of surprise. And the problem with that is that for a direct attack, if China wanted to escalate from that point, surprise is very, very important. Because if you're launching an amphibious invasion, you definitely want as much surprise as you can get. Because surprise is not quite the technically right word. It's more like movement without generating a response. We may see it as long as it doesn't catalyze a political military response. And the thing is, the lesson of the Ukraine war isn't that it can't be done. It can definitely be done. You just got to do it right. I think the lesson of the Ukraine war is the Russians screwed up big time. They didn't, I mean, the way I put it is, if you were thinking of sending two missiles, send six. If you were thinking of somebody who's going to defect, kill them. If you were thinking of dropping 10,000 guys, drop 25,000 guys. You know, that sort of thing. Like, leave nothing to chance. I mean, we took over Iraq in 2003. It's definitely doable. It's just, I think, in the case of the Ukraine war, the Russians probably overestimated their own capability and underestimated the Ukrainians. It's possible we're underestimating the Chinese and overestimating the Taiwanese. It's possible you got it about right. But if that means if I were a Chinese planner, I would just say, let's pad a lot more certainty into our calculations. And that's what I think Burns, for instance, was talking about the other day or yesterday on CBS about how China might not quite be confident yet. Because, you know, you're not, if you're China, you're not going to do this if you don't think you're going to be successful. And that's what we have going for us, is it's a tough thing to do. And there's a lot of risk for China. And if Xi Jinping fails, it's very bad for him. So even if, say, China's like 51% confident, that might not be enough. I mean, if I were China, I wouldn't do it with 51% confidence. I'd want to be more like 80% confident.
Yeah. And the thing too, couple responses. So number one, another clear lesson of the Ukraine war is just the political side. So when you were talking about how a cost of the blockade is people are starving, people are dying. It's barbaric, frankly, in terms of what it would actually reflect upon China's actions in the, you know, case of social media, which drives the American political response.
Right.
If the Russians could go back in time, them allowing Bucha and like other like incidents entirely changed the dynamic. So it's one thing to invade and it's just acquiesce, but if you just have weeks and weeks and weeks of starving Taiwanese people.
Terrible.
It's the demand in allied countries for intervention attack is just going to be really heightened. So I really wanted to emphasize that point.
Yeah, exactly right. That's a great point. Exactly.
I think another question, and this is another lesson of the Ukraine war, which is that this just the salience of national identity and willingness to fight. So if we're going to contrast, let's say, the fall of Afghanistan to the Taliban with the fall of Ukraine, Afghan national identity overstated in terms of willingness to like fight this or that, identification with the status quo government, whatever. Ukraine, the Russians make the opposite mistake, assuming that Ukrainian national identity, but also just loyalty to the government was much lower than it was. How do you think about that dynamic in Taiwan and the degree to which the Chinese are probably, because if I'm a Chinese planner, I'm thinking, okay, open arms, or is this another resistance situation?
Yeah, hard to know. You know, you hear different things about the Taiwanese that they don't. I mean, they clearly don't want to fall under Chinese, you know, communist control. The question is how resolute are they? I think if I were a Chinese planner, and therefore how I'm thinking about it from our perspective is, I wouldn't take any chances. I wouldn't expect to be welcomed with open arms. And I don't think the Chinese do. I mean, because if you see the way they talk about splitists and independent separate, I mean, political warfare kind of stuff, I don't think they have delusions that the Taiwanese, you know, I'm sure there's some on Taiwan who would, including some in important positions possibly. But I don't think it's, you know, and I think that's clearly a lesson of this conflict for China is like, don't bet on that. And you know, don't take any chances.
You're not, you know, pulling the Russian move of packing your dress uniforms for the, you know, march through Kyiv in this scenario.
We made that mistake too, right? I mean, they will welcome us as liberators and that kind of stuff. So it's not impossible the Chinese make the mistake. My general point is, it's possible the Chinese make mistakes. If they make a mistake, they'll be easier to handle. So we should assume that they won't make mistakes, or, you know, macro mistakes.
So before I pivot off of this broad topic, I just want to really pick up a metaphor that I really enjoy this metaphor because it's going to help me think through the administration's discourse on this topic, which is everyone, to your point, says we're alcoholics. That's the generic line. But there's a difference between saying, look, it is an accomplishment to admit you're an alcoholic, like it's acknowledged.
Yeah, it is. No, it's critical. It's the first step. It's critical.
The first step, but the follow-up question, if it's your family, your friends, your employer is, okay, like what now? So the broad consensus is we're alcoholics. Mm-hmm. What is your, I don't want to say alternative path because it's all, I think it's things are pretty up for grabs, especially given the now conventional acknowledgement of a long-term Ukraine war. I think that acknowledgement is actually deeply important in terms of how we're thinking about this, because if you can't say this is a 6-8 month thing, it has to change how you think about this. What is the Bridge Kobe 12-step program? If we're accepting, or maybe pick a different program.
The metaphor carries. It's like, I have this metaphor about Taiwan as a man in the water with a shark that I love, but, But I think it carries.
You can't drop that and not give me the metaphor of the shark.
Okay, so the metaphor of the shark, I'll try to be brief, and it really works in my view. The Taiwanese don't love it, but it really works. It's like Taiwan is a man with a cut. I was in the water last spring with my wife, and we got a cold in because there was a shark, and I couldn't see the shark in the water. The lifeguard could see the shark. We couldn't see the shark, even though we were closer to it. Pulled us out. Here's how it goes. Taiwan, a man with a cut in the water. There's America is a man in a boat. And is saying there's a great white shark in the water. Taiwan, swim over here. I'm not going to jump in the water because I, you know, we're friends, but I got a family. Like, sorry, you're not like the most important thing in my world, but I will stick my hand and risk my hand getting bitten off to help you, but you got to swim. And Taiwan is the way the way you can explain a lot of what's like at a human level, what's happening in Taiwan is they're kind of paralyzed, right? I mean, they are doing some things, but not clearly not in the right order of magnitude, given the scale of the threat. Is like, if you're a man in the water, and someone's telling you there's a great white shark and you need to swim, well, are you sure he's right? Maybe he's wrong, right? But even more to the point, if I start swimming, that is building up, getting more serious, maybe, you know, kicking in the water provokes sharks. You know, there's this huge shark out there. It's faster than I am to get to the boat. I'm going to get eaten, you know? So like, that's sort of another thing. And so it's like, and then maybe you're thinking like, maybe it's not a great white shark. Maybe it's like a, you know, it's like a reef shark, you know, so I'll get bit, but like, I don't need to worry about it. Maybe the PLA is not so strong. Anyway, so I think that metaphor actually kind of works, right? And the other thing about it is like, America's in the boat. We can see the size of the shark. And actually, because like our overhead, our intelligence apparatus is much better than Taiwan's. Taiwan has better kind of finger feel of China and China's culture. Like they helped, I think they dealt with COVID a lot better. They shut down Taiwan much before America shut down, like months, I think, if I'm not mistaken. So they have a better sense of like China at like the kind of regular level. But like we're talking here, we're not talking about what people in like Guangdong think. We're talking about what the leadership is doing, what the PLA is doing. That is, you're better off with like the big. So anyway, that's my metaphor.
Yeah, and the just other one, metaphor, and real quick, yeah. I accept the metaphor as a non-Taiwanese person, but I think the other thing that the metaphor gets at is just, and maybe you said this, but the status quo is working. You're swimming.
You're swimming.
You're with your family. It's because there was, I was thinking of this because I saw just a kind of anti-Taiwan account tweet, quote, they tweeted, quote, only 5% of Taiwanese people want independence. America, stop forcing. It was one of the way too hard in the paint.
Why are you bringing up the shark?
Yeah. I don't, and it's just know, like another nice way of here. Restating the 5% point is they like the status quo. They don't want to declare. No, you and I are not advocating for the Taiwanese to say no. Forget, the currency. Oh, like most Taiwanese people, into your metaphor, are swimming and it's nice and it's a nice day.
Right. In fact, my view is like, don't like punch the shark. Don't like swim over by the shark and like poke it in the eye. That's a bad idea. Like get out of the water. That's your first thing. Yeah. You know, don't declare independence. Don't do like unnecessarily provocative things. Like don't unnecessarily splash around, like kind of calmly try to get to the boat. That's like, That's a great point. I think you just refined the metaphor.
No, it's good. I'm glad we did the tangent, but yeah, back to your original point.
So the 12-step problem is great because actually, I mean, look, the 12-step program is actually, the metaphor works here as well. It's pretty straightforward. I actually don't know offhand what the 12 steps are, but like, you know, I think they're pretty well established, you know, AA or whatever, you know, discipline, prayer, I think, you know, if you're a believer, et cetera, and so it's like, Like we don't have to overcomplicate. What we need in the Pacific is we need military investment. We need a sense of urgency. We need to put pressure on the Asian partners and allies to do more. We need to be ready. We need to paper over in the near term, as Mike Gallagher points out, like the anti-Navy. We need to shift resources. It's like that stuff is actually, we kind of like know a lot of it. I mean, some of it is complicated. A lot of it's complicated kind of technically, but like at the macro level, it's not that complicated. The problem where we are is like, you know, we're saying that we have the drinking problem, but we're not really, it's like or drug addiction where people are like, yeah, I need to get over this, but like you keep doing it. And how do you get a person psychologically to change that? That's a lot of what I'm wrestling with now is like we've admitted that we have the problem, but we're not actually following through. And that's a really hard, and maybe, I guess my logic to continue the metaphor is like an intervention. And like, here's what we look like, you know, like here, hey, Bob, here's what it looks like when you get really drunk. And do you want this? This is, you know, your family, blah, 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 blah. You know what I mean? Like that, that's sort of my, I guess there are other approaches to dealing with someone in that situation, but mine's like the cold light of day. Here's the reality. And if we grapple with the reality, we'll be more incentivized and likely to shift focus as we need to.
My final double down on the 12 step program metaphor, because like you, I can't actually name out the 12 steps, but one of the steps that I do know, because I think the metaphor is important, is the, accepting a higher power idea, separating it from purely like accepting like God or Jesus or whatever, and treating it as acknowledging some like inconvenient fact. In this case, there's something like greater than yours. There's something inconvenient. Like what is something inconvenient that we're going to accept about this 12-step program? Because honestly,
exactly.
If I'm in the Biden admin and I'm like, you know, the equivalent of you, hearing that actually my plans aren't working and things aren't as great as they are, like I wouldn't, that's not, that sucks, but I don't think that's not that insurmountable. Do you think there's like a deeper, you know what this probably is? I think my version of that for you would be that the deep truth that we don't want to accept is that China is the equivalent of 1941 exactly. America.
I think that entirely
blows up my entire frame of the world.
Right. And I think you see this on both sides, actually. In fact, in some ways more on the Republican side, which is it's acceptance that we are not like the unipole. And I think the political leadership in a lot of Washington, and including on the Republican side, is really wedded to the idea that we are, you know, the indispensable nation, Madeleine Albright. I mean, we are kind of indispensable instrumentally in various places, but like reckoning that China is like a peer is such a change that like and this is the critique that the Chinese make of us. I don't think it actually is true with respect to my argument, but I think it is true to some extent with respect to official Washington and like blobby Washington, which is you can't accept not being totally number one. Because in a sense, my argument is like, I mean, we're tied for number one. Like, so let's make sure we're kind of edging out as number, you know, I mean, number one doesn't really matter. Like, yeah. It just matters whether Americans are free, prosperous, and secure. But realistically, we kind of have to be up there given anyway. But I think when I try to get like the things, it's this hubris about America and this unwillingness. And it's reflected in the walk and chew gum thing. That's why I go just hammer on that all the time, is because
can you explain the debate you're speaking about?
Yeah. So whenever like John Kirby or one of these people is asked about what are we doing in Asia, he says the US can walk and chew gum at the same time. And it's just, you know, to you take another metaphor, it's so revealing because it's like, what is walking and chewing gum? Oh, you're having on the street and you're just like chewing gum. Like that's easy. Like, and you know, 4-year-old should
thank
be
you
able
for
to
putting
do that.
It that way, because I've actually never, you're right, that's actually a very easy thing.
Yeah, well, I'm always like well, how about wrestling a dragon and sprinting a marathon? Like that would be like kind of that's really pretty hard. Like now I see what you're talking about. That would be, I think that would be much more accurate, you know, because like, you know, we're not like just like, is China the walking or the chewing gum? Like no right. And nobody in like, you know, the thing about walking and chewing gum, like no successful business is like, hey, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. Like it's obvious. I mean, I'm not a successful businessman, but like it's obvious successful businesses pick their priorities very carefully and go after them. Like Apple and the iPhone. I mean, again, I'm not an expert, but like
stretching.
It's just basic. It's just basic, right? And it's just so revealing. And the fact that the Democrats and the Republicans, a lot of them, the sort of traditional ones, just like completely sign on to that is so revealing about where the mindset is. And it's just, it's really not accurate. And if you talk to commercial people, they're obviously Asia and China is the world's biggest market, you know? And so there's like this real disconnect that I think a lot of it is explained by age, honestly. I think the way I think about it is like a lot of people in Washington still think the Chinese are riding around on bicycles and wearing mouse suits. You know, there's a picture somebody put on Twitter of like the change in Shanghai from over the last 20 or 30 years. And it's like, you know, that's just, there's probably well over 100 cities like that in China, probably maybe like into the several hundreds, you know, just the scale of what's happening. And people are like, yeah, we can chew gum. Like that's easy. No problem. No, wrong.
So two last big things. So number one, I wonder, I do a lot of like thinking around the like post like neoliberalism space and This podcast is funded by the Hewitt Foundation, which is like center left. So, you know, I'm thinking about this, but they tend not to be as focused on the foreign policy aspect. I wonder if some of the reluctance on the GOP / conservative side to take some of your arguments seriously is it really puts you in an awkward place, because there seems to be a degree of government needs to do X. There needs to be energy here. Because I think the center left to left version is like, we just don't think about these issues. So that explains some of the difficulty there. But I think on the right side, I think there's something a little too FDR-y about this industrial based discourse. Maybe I'm wrong, but I'm just kind of like having, I'm curious.
What you're thinking. Well, China is so critical to the whole neoliberal thing. And I'm going to, I have my own sympathies. Like I'm sort of, my own personal sympathies are more new righty, as I think, you know, but I want to hear just be really like clinical about it and try to abstract from those personal preferences, because I think your point is exactly right. And objectively so, China is critical to the whole, the whole China debate is critical to the whole neoliberal versus industrial policy and so forth, new right, kind of new left or whatever kind of debate, because China is the huge market that is the symbiotic relationship for the financialization and servicization of the American economy, right? We knowingly offshored a huge amount of that. And the basic neoliberal argument on the right, the sort of neoclassical economics, was that, like, basically, two points, and these, the second one is not emphasized enough. One is that China would liberalize. Okay, maybe. Secondly, more importantly, and this is the critical claim, is that we would outcompete them anyway. And that is the one that's been wrong. That is the one that's been wrong. The Chinese have not just, like, they don't just make toy cars and whatever. They are ascending the value chain through massive industrial policy. So my view is that, like, whatever one thinks of industrial or like state intervention in the economy in like a vacuum, and there are useful and important debates about that. What has been, I think, conclusively demonstrated to be untrue is that we cannot do state intervention in the economy and have a massive Jupiter-sized economy also doing industrial policy and succeed. So, like, whatever you think, like, you might be a Milton Friedman guy in the vacuum, but I think you have to recognize that in the face of massive industrial policy by the world's other largest economy, we also need to be, we can't be like fighting with both hands tied behind our back. And that is very difficult. And it also connects to cui bono, who benefited in this globalization of the economy. And I don't want to get too moralistic about it, you know, personally, but just like it's connected to obviously Wall Street, Hollywood, et cetera, consulting firms, et cetera, that benefit from this Chimerica kind of model. And when you're breaking that apart, and by the way, I don't think full-scale decoupling is necessary for reasons I can get into, but I think that it's touching on real, and that's part of the thing I think that's going on also. We love to lambaste the Germans, and nobody loves to lambaste the Germans more than I do, but about...
And you mean like status quo 2023 Germans, not the Nazis or like, well, the Kaiser.
Right. I mean, of course, hopefully we're all right. But I mean, like today, but yeah, like, yeah. For being enmeshed with the Russians and the difficulty they have in enmeshing themselves. This is a huge hypocrisy on our part. Huge. We are deeply enmeshed with a country that is 10 times the economic size. And by the way, the Indians point this out, which I appreciate to our face. We built up China, and we are the ones who are having difficulty enmeshing. And people are like, are really enmeshed, right? I mean, obviously there's Tim Cook and all these things, but like the most powerful people in our society are deeply enmeshed in China. And we have the audacity to lecture the Germans on this point. So it's easy for us to, here's the thing. It's kind of easier for us to have the Russians as the bête noire, you know, or the bad guy, because like, we're not really exposed. It doesn't involve any significant changes, but it's much less consequential. Whereas China is like, that's real for us. But yes, it's real for us. That's why we need to take it seriously. And like, my view is like, all right, if you invested and you were big on China, you know, in the past, okay, like nobody's perfect. Like I'm not perfect, like, whatever. I certainly don't claim that, but it's like, don't do the Hank Paulson, you know, that's like kind of shameful. Like don't double down like that. I mean, that seriously, at least like recognize this is where things are. We need to move forward. And that's, I think, a big part of the explanation why it's been so difficult is because it is consequential. In a sense, we are analogous to the situation with the Germans and Russia.
You know, since you brought up the decoupling, debate. I'll note that I think Friday's episode is going to be with Vivek Ramaswamy, who one of his planks is a complete decoupling with China. I don't need you to like argue with a guest who's not here, but I think I'll just kind of express a concern I have, which is that on the right side of the aisle, we're in this because the right has basically, because large parts of like the dissident insurgent right have really harshly pushed back against, like, let's say, like the bipartisan Ukraine consensus. I think some people are over escalating in the opposite direction on Taiwan. So, but kind of by like, by so basically saying, look, like, you know, Ukraine, it's like not the big thing, but actually China's the whole thing. So we need to completely decouple, right, or we need to endorse Taiwanese independence. Right. It seems like we've and something you've done in this episode very well is you said, okay, here's my personal opinion. Let me step back and be analytical. I don't get the sense that a lot of our GOP, well, not ours, I don't identify as a member of the GOP, but like a lot of the GOP's conversation about China policy has left the realm of analysis and analytics and risk. They're kind of doing their own version of what they claim the center left is doing in Ukraine. So can you just offer some, just like, how should the GOP, who has not seriously thought about this issue until recently, how should they ground themselves and think about it? Because my final question, by the way, is going to be about the 20th anniversary of the Iraq War, which is like the perfect example of what happens when you over-escalate, don't think deeply about things, blah, 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 blah.
Well, thanks. No, I actually, I mean, it's certainly in the sense that we shouldn't over-escalate in the other direction. I fully agree. And that's why I really try to stick to my line. And for instance, like, I don't think the Russians are the good guys. I think the Ukrainians are totally just in their defense, and I sympathize with them. It's not about that. Like, I'm trying to say, what is in the American people's interests? Let's do that thing based on a practical read of what resources are available or realistically going to be available. And so in the case of Ukraine, that means we cannot do the level that we have been doing. I don't think it's tenable under current circumstances. Likewise with Taiwan and China, we don't need to go. There's a line from a movie that's not a very nice one. But anyway, sort of like, we can't go full out there, you know. We don't need to. We need to know.
Oh my gosh, that was a Tropic Thunder reference.
Dating myself.
People could figure it out.
People figure it out. I didn't say it, but we you know, in part because of the scale of the things that I was just talking about, it's going to be really, really painful to deal with China. So let's not overdo it. Both because I think people understand that I genuinely want to avoid a war. I mean, that is the whole point here. Like, but on the other hand, if a war comes, we need to be able to win it, because that alternative is worse. And the best way to be prepared for a war and to deter it is to deter it and keep your demands at a level that's consistent with what the other side can with dignity accept, or like sufficient dignity accept. And I think that the decoupling thing, the way I think about it, and a lot of my friends are in favor of full-scale decoupling. My point is, here's what we need to deal with China. If people want full-scale decoupling for other reasons or to go beyond that, I think that's a worthwhile, very worthwhile conversation to have. But I really think we are tending to overthink the dealing with China problem, which is like, if we can keep the military balance sufficient, they are not going to be able to impose their will on other countries in Asia. I think it's that simple. And the good news about that is it means we don't have to totally overhaul our economy. So maybe, you know, Hank Paulson is wrong, or Bob Zoellick, but on the other hand, we don't need to go full statist either. And I think this is also, the left tends to frame it in sort of racial terms, or, you know, but I also think, you know, I mean, those are legitimate. I oppose anti-Asian discrimination or hostility of any kind, but like, you know, it's also, we don't need to like overhaul our society to deal with like misinformation, disinformation, whatever that is. Like, we don't need to like root out every form of Chinese influence. There's going to be Chinese influence. If we get the military balance right, we can afford to trade a lot with the Chinese. You just got to be prepared for that to go away. I mean, McDonald's and others are apparently reinvesting in China. Okay, but don't expect the American people to bail you out. And if I had a position of influence in that context, I would not bail them out. You know, that was your decision. You took on the risk, but that's up to you. Okay, but you know, we can afford it as long as we can sink their fleet. I think that's a very important, I think it's a conservative point, because it's sort of like the war is the health of the state aspect, where like there is a danger that, I mean, you know, this is kind of a canard often, but like the McCarthy era, 50s McCarthy, is a danger. Like if we overtake it, and I actually think the left is more affected by this on the Russia stuff now. I mean, they've let the Putin mania, and Putin's an evil guy. Like, he's an enemy of the United States, but like, he's not, you know, he's not like Satan, right? Like, he's mortal. He's obviously made bad decisions, like, et cetera. He controls an economy that's 1/10 the size of China. Like, let's look at this. Let's look at, I actually just put on Twitter before I started, is something, it's like, over the last year, it's like, you know, I've made a mistake in some ways, like, because I, the way I think about our, how we should think about our foreign policy is almost like as a fiduciary, you know, like, we're fiduciary, people who do our foreign policy should be fiduciaries of the American people. So it's like a business kind of thing, you know, you have friends if you're in a business environment, but you're also competitive and you expect them to do their part if they work at the same company. It's competitive, you know, that's the nature of the business. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people do think of foreign policy as almost like a substitute religion. I mean, that, you know, you look at like how Fukuyama has talked over the last year, which is disappointing because I actually thought he had been unfairly characterized over the years, but he's sort of fallen into the own stereotype. But it's like there is this sort of millenarian element to the discourse that's, I mean, that's part of the problem. I don't know how that relates to the 12-step. You know, maybe they're smoking peyote or something in some, like, a religious experience, you know, and that's a lot harder to convince somebody to get off of.
Yeah. So the last question, you know, 20th anniversary of the war in Iraq. I'm just, not between us, because this is the podcast, I'm obsessed with the war in Iraq right now, just because, yeah. It's been enough time that I think most people, especially in my generation of cohort, either yes. never learned anything about it beyond just like the top end talking points, or B, people who are like older are kind of using it to advance like their own political objectives. So like mm-hmm. I had a great conversation with Christopher Miller. He was the, you know, Trump's final acting secretary mm-hmm. of defense. And, you know, during the conversation, we're talking about Iraq and he's talking about, oh, you know, the generals, like they weren't like punished. And I'm like, wait, like, let's go through the decisions you thought were bad. That's Paul Bremer. He's a civilian. Okay. Like that's someone political in White House over like overriding General Shinseki, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right. If we're going to make the claims we're making about the war, I think like actually analyzing it and trying to separating the political objectives in terms of like trying to win fights today mm-hmm. From that is actually really key. So I'm just curious, like just what, you know, like what are your broad thoughts like on the anniversary? Cause this yeah, was, what's yep. fascinating for me is like when you were like my age, first right. coming to DC, right. that was your centerpiece. Mm-hmm. That was, I think exactly. that was the main focus.
Yeah. So I sort of experienced it quite, I mean, I was not in any important role or anything, but I was very much in the ether, you know, I was working at the State Department as a very junior person at the time, but I'm working on something on this. I think it's very important that we understand Iraq correctly, in part because I think the Ukraine war has resuscitated some of the people, Kagan is actually a good example, and arguments that I think should be discredited by the Iraq War. I think the Iraq War was a mistake from its conception. So I actually think, you know, Bremer did a lot of things badly, but I don't think Bremer ultimately holds the bag. I think the Iraq War, and some of this has been forgotten because as it's been sort of litigated, the actual aims, the implicit aims have narrowed. But at the time, and this is like being in Washington, they were very expansive. I mean, it basically was the representation of a foreign policy that's not dissimilar to the kind of like, you know, Putin is going to be regime changed and Russia is going to turn into a democracy. I mean, that's sort of basically the idea that American force and influence could be used to kind of conclusively resolve problems. And, it, you know, that's sort of back right now. And a lot of the people who, I mean, I mentioned Fukuyama, who had sort of been chastened or had taken knocks because of it, have now kind of come back. And sadly, I mean, I think the war in Ukraine is a much juster cause than the invasion of Iraq, just to be clear. But I think I fear that it will bear certain kinds of similarities to the situation where very ostensibly noble aims are not reachable in a way, and they're going to have immediate but also secondary and tertiary consequences that we can't fully anticipate that are going to be a problem. I mean, I think the Iraq War decision was a disaster. I think overthrowing Saddam Hussein could reasonably be anticipated at the time to have meant the likelihood of instability in the region, that it would not solve the proliferation problem through, because it's critical to it, like the Cheneyan sort of views, that the demonstration of American dominance would cow everybody. And actually, in some cases, it may have had that effect, But in other cases, it didn't, like the Iranian nuclear program, which we now live with, right?
We get Gaddafi, we don't get Iran.
You get Gaddafi, you get Syria and ISIS. So like, just very clearly, it didn't succeed anywhere near what they actually wanted to achieve. You know, I don't think they would have gone to war if it was just like, oh, we're going to narrowly deal with the WMD program and have all of these problems. I mean, that would have been crazy. And the thing to remember is how advantageous our position was in 2000, how we squandered. There really is no need for us to be worried about our Taiwan defensibility. That is like, basically, the Iraq decision and the nation-building campaign in Afghanistan directly contributed to that. It's not the only reason. There's a lot of ways, mistakes, yada, yada. But like, it definitely made it. Otherwise, there were people in the Pentagon 10, 12 years ago who were like, we need to solve this problem. And people like Bob Gates, who relative to some of these people is a force of wisdom and moderation. He was like, no, this is the war we're in. And that's where we are. And so it's really important that we understand, in my view. And I've always thought that a lot of people who blame Blemmer and the dismissal of the Ba'ath and so forth in the army were basically trying to escape the fact that they signed on to the original thing. And again, I'm not like all there keeping score about who, but like, I do think it's important when somebody still holds to those views and then is seeking to have influence in the current debate. I think that's important. You know, someone like Tucker Carlson said, I was wrong. Like I admire that. Like, who hasn't been wrong, right? We're all fallible. But I think it's important that is, I agree with you, this is very important. I also agree with you, we shouldn't overlearn it, that like the Americans, the bad guys or whatever. My view is it was worse than a crime. It was a blunder. But that's where we are today. And I think it's critical to recognize that.
Yeah. Just to close, I love where you ended up. Cause key claim, I'm not a weird revisionist who's like, actually everything was great until that Paul Bremer dude showed up.
No, I know you're not.
It's just that like, we should be, I just was like really struggling. And this is where I was kind of pushing it. I'm like, wait, like if we actually, like how much of our beef is with like Ricardo Sanchez, if anyone even remembers who he was.
I do.
Defense person. Versus like a broad civilian operator. And I'm looking the last thing here too. And this is
politicians. But although I think we should take with a grain of salt a lot of these generals who are on TV all the time. But
fair.
But it's definitely
Ricardo Sanchez did not get his TV deal.
Political strategic decision, and it was not the intelligence community's fault either. Although they also made mistakes, but it was a political strategic decision, and that's where the responsibility should lie.
So yeah, I think that is a excellent place to leave it. Which has been really great. Do you have anything? So obviously, could you just shout the book out? Has the book aged well? 2021, is it still worth like shouting out the book?
Actually, well, I'm biased, but yes, I think so. I deliberately wrote it to age. You know, I'm hoping my aspiration is going to be readable in 25 years, but I think it's certainly, if anything, it's probably even more relevant because the threat has increased from China and we're more distracted than we were even when I published it. So actually, I think if anything, the book is more relevant than ever. So it's The Strategy of Denial, American Defense in an Age of Great Power Conflict from Yale University Press, now out in paperback.
Excellent. Thank you for joining me on The Realignment.
Great. Thanks, Marshall.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.